Great. Great, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure to be here. I'm glad I got in. It was snowing in Chicago and snowing here, and it was dicey. But I'm here, and I'm glad. It's exciting. Great, so today I'm going to talk about small dots, which are these. More like islands, but islands doesn't sound as good as small dots, whatever. Studying collective phenomena on arrays of superconducting islands. Okay, so I'll start by just giving a general introduction to what I mean by collective phenomena, and then go on to what I think is one of the greatest examples of collective behavior in materials, which is superconductivity, and then talk about how we're trying to control and understand the collective behavior of superconductors by coupling together individual superconducting islands, which is what you see here, and then talk about the physics we study in this case, which is looking at things like anomalous metallic states that are not quite superconducting, not quite normal metals, looking at things like vortex interactions in these systems. And I will be a bad humorist, but hopefully a good physicist, by giving you the punchline first. And the punchline is that, you know, I hope to show that these island arrays that we study are really model systems for better understanding collective behavior. So they both give us insight into the nature of superconductivity in, say, two dimensions, as well as into insight into just general issues relevant to collective behavior, the role of disorder, the role of phase separation. And hopefully, you know, you'll see what I mean by this. Okay, so first, what is collective phenomena? Right. So collective phenomena, as defined here, occurs when you have interactions between particles in a multi-particle system that leads to a new phase. And that phase, that new phase, is different from that of any individual particle. Okay. So here's an example of collective phenomena. It's a wave of people in a stadium. The particle is the person sitting around over there. The new phase is this soliton of raised arms, I guess, that propagates around the stadium, right? And that's totally different from any individual person. Okay. Or another example of collective phenomena is an ant bridge. You know, you have just an ant scurrying aimlessly around a countertop, has nothing to do, right? But you put a bunch of them together, they find a leaf that's more tasty, and they self-organize into a bridge that allows them to get what they want. Right. So that's collective behavior. It takes, you know, these big things interact and make entirely new structures that can do, that are entirely different from the individual things. I think that in physics, you know, we're kind of accustomed to thinking, or, you know, in life in general, we're accustomed to thinking of collective behavior. But for physics, what's often most interesting is what interactions are leading to that collective behavior. Right? It's not just that things act collectively, but there has to be some particle interaction that gives you that interesting phase. So, you know, in the case of people in a stadium, right, it's a person-person interaction, right? And so the person-person interaction requires that the person sitting over here has to look over and see this happening, something visual. They have to understand what a wave is, what they're supposed to do. And then they have to time it so that when it comes towards them, they can feel the motion of the person next to them and raise their arms in time and therefore do the thing that goes around. So in this case, I'd call the interaction cognitive, visual, and emotional, right? Those are the person-person interactions. In the case of the ant bridge, right, ants have very keen senses of touch and smell. That's what allows them, you know, to form these sort of things in an organized way. But they also obey something that's called swarm rules, right? I admittedly really don't know what this is, but it's what gets them from these individual things to swarming into a useful structure. I feel like it's something that as humans we could really learn from, because, you know, you get a swarm of people together and you just get, I don't know, a riot or something, right? And you get a swarm of ants together and they make a bridge. I mean, we would never do that, right? So we should figure out these swarm rules and apply them somehow. Now, in materials, one of the most common collective phenomena is this magnetism, right? You have individual electrons that have dipole moments that could be either due to spin or to orbital behavior, and then these dipoles interact, right? If they're all lined up, you get ferromagnetism. If they're anti-aligned, you get anti-ferromagnetism. Again, anti-ferromagnetism is a long-range collective phenomena that's different from just having one spin sitting around. Or you can have things like spin waves that propagate across material. Right, so collective phenomena appears in many different sorts of systems, right? From insects, as I mentioned, to the internet, right? Presumably, that's why a billion people have seen Gangnam Style, sort of collective phase transition to the Gangnam. I don't know, and then you know, to crowds, materials, genetics. Here's one of my favorite papers on collective phenomena: life is physics. Evolution is a collective phenomena far from equilibrium. So they're arguing that genetic mutations actually act collectively, and by applying our understanding of collective behavior in physics, we can understand the evolution of genes and therefore understand all of life in that way, which is kind of neat. And you know, the other thing to note is that this sort of collective phenomena is really often very complex. And it's difficult to predict the phenomena that occur just from knowing the individual components, right? So you might know what a dipole is, but even knowing that, you may not be able to predict what, you know, where a spin wave occurs in a material, right? So these collective behaviors are complex and just, you know, call them emergent sometimes because they emerge from the individual interactions in complex ways. So solid-state systems are inherently correlated multi-particle systems, right? In order to condense into a solid state, you have all these atoms and electrons together, and they self-organize to make a solid, right? There's just an immense number, you know, Avogadro's number of atoms and electrons that are condensed into this space, okay? And, you know, these things are charged, so things like charge interactions themselves lead to well-known collective phases, right? Just atoms self-organizing into a crystal is a collective phase. Right, and that's often an insulator, so it's not that interesting electronically because it just sort of does not much, at least from a transport point of view, but it's collective. And metals themselves are collective. The electrons are strongly interacting in metals, right? And they form this sort of collective, just free form of metals in this material. Now, in the case of metals, you can sort of renormalize their mass to consider them as non-interacting gas of electrons in materials and metals that move around. And so, you know, so even though electrons in metals are collective, we treat them as a non-interacting electron gas, and they become sort of, again, uninteresting from maybe a transport point of view. Useful, but not that interesting in terms of interest, you know, emergent phenomena. But then if you start adding other things together, you know, charge interactions, spin interactions, lattice interactions, if you start having competing phenomena where it's almost ferromagnetic and almost paramagnetic and almost ferroelectric, then you start getting really interesting emergent behavior in these systems and really more interesting phases, right? So an example is magnetism, as I mentioned. You can have anti-ferromagnetism spin waves. There are things called multiferroics, which have often competing or or at the same time spin and charge order. Things like barium titanate is a multiferroic. Here you can see that they have things like both ferromagnetic domains and ferroelectric domains, and these can coexist and create domain walls, so you get very interesting emergent behavior in these cases. There are frustrated crystals, things like spinels, where atoms in certain sites are geometrically frustrated. That leads to, again, this competition between, say, magnetism and charge ordering, which leads to new phases in this case. In 1D systems, you don't have free electron gases. You have strongly interacting 1D electrons that create new phases called things like Luttinger liquids, which are identified by things like separation of the spin and charge degrees of freedom, right? That's really crazy. So spin and charge are no longer the same parameter in this case. And that's, again, due to interactions in 1D. Or you have superconductivity, which is due to pairing of electrons. So you go from something that's just individual dissipative electrons to them paired up and having no dissipation whatsoever, just a collective effect. And I want to note that, you know, it's interesting, you know, collective behavior to me is not just interesting because, you know, that's sort of how, you know, it could be the origin of life as far as we know, you know, genetics and everything come from collective behavior, but also that they're useful in functional devices, right? Magnetic devices, very useful. For superconducting devices can be very useful in and of themselves. On top of that, there's sort of new interest in understanding collective behavior because for most of our solid-state devices, we use charges moving around, and charges move with dissipation, right? You lose energy as heat. There's this huge heat problem in transistors that they dissipate more power than we can cool these days. Everyone's trying to solve it. I mean, it turns out that you may be able to solve this by using, instead of individual charges moving around, some collective behavior of electrons or other things moving around in transistors and in solid-state devices. And that collective behavior often is less dissipative than individual charges. And so collective effects could enable future technologies, things like solar cells, low-power transistors, and high-density memory. So there's a lot of interest in really understanding these sort of phenomena. I don't know why that S is, but anyway. So I'm going to focus now on superconductivity because for, you know, a couple of reasons. One is that I think, as I mentioned, I think it's a really great example of collective behavior, right? It's also very useful in and of itself, and I hope to show that some of the questions that we can start thinking about and answering in superconducting systems are generally relevant to understanding collective electronic effects. Okay. So superconductivity, we just passed the 100th anniversary of the discovery of superconductivity. Kennerling Onnes discovered a method of liquefying helium. So helium liquefies at 4 Kelvin, so he was able to attain much lower temperatures than anyone could attain before. So as soon as he learned to liquefy helium, he just put materials into his system, right, and saw what does iron do at 4 Kelvin, what does silver do at 4 Kelvin, what does mercury do at 4 Kelvin, right? He just systematically went through all these things, and he found that in the case of mercury, right, when it was at higher temperatures, it was just like a metal, and it had some resistance. And then suddenly, when he got to a temperature around, 4.2 Kelvin, the resistance suddenly went away. You got a transition from a resistive state to a zero resistive state all of a sudden. This was entirely unexpected. So I think this graph should teach us we can learn three things from this graph, okay? The first thing is that this was unexpected, and it was enabled by a new technology. So developing new technologies, right, such as ability to liquefy helium, can open up entirely new areas of science, right? So it's a really big motivation for developing new things, new methods, new techniques, and that could open entirely new scientific areas. The second lesson here is that, actually, I believe that Kennerling Onnes wasn't even in the lab when this graph was taken. It was actually his assistant who took all this data, and yet he was the one who got all the credit for it. So the second lesson is that it's good to be the boss, okay? Hopefully we all get there someday. And the third lesson is that's really cool, right? Zero resistance, totally unexpected, that's neat. And you should still be amazed by this. I know you've all seen this before, but it's still really an amazing thing, right? That you have normal metals, three-dimensional metals, as you cool them down to low temperature, they just stay resistive, and yet there are some materials, you get to some transition temperature, and all the resistance goes away. It still is amazing to think that can occur in nature. And it occurs because it's a collective phenomena inherently, right? So basically, superconductivity occurs because of an attractive interaction between electrons that's mediated by the ions in the lattice. Okay, so the ions in the lattice cause the electrons to be attractively to attract each other. The electrons then move over or interact over length scales, basically larger than any sort of scattering they'd feel in the material in the lattice, and they can move without losing any energy to the lattice that way. Okay. The transport occurs via these opposite paired spin electrons, which have the same phase, right? So these electrons pair up, right? They can be described by some wave function, where a wave function has an amplitude and some phase, and so all the pairs have an identical phase, they're phase coherent. Right, and these are called Cooper pairs. They have this new ground state. It's a collective effect. So just to go through this sort of Wikipedia type list of what is superconductivity? It's an electron-phonon interaction leads to some attraction of electrons. You get Cooper pairs bound opposite spin electrons, momentum and spin. They can condense into one lowest energy state described by a macroscopic wave function and a phase. This pairing leads to a gap to single particle state since you only have paired up states. And then this gap energy is related to the transition temperature of the superconductivity. Okay. So, you would think that this superconductivity was kind of unexpected because if you had just told someone this would happen, you'd think they were kind of crazy, right? Why would that must be really esoteric, right? But on the other, it turns out that almost all metals are superconducting at a low enough temperature, right? This is one of these things in the nature that if it can do it, it does it. Right? You can condense this low energy state, and it just happens. And so all these elemental materials transition to superconductivity at different temperatures. We have things like niobium transitioning at 9.5 Kelvin. Then you can make alloys of superconductors that transition at even higher temperatures. For example, niobium-3 tin has a transition temperature of 18 Kelvin. This can actually sustain large magnetic fields. This is used in MRI magnets. Right? And then there's a whole other class of materials that transition at much higher temperatures. There are these high-temperature superconductors, these copper-based copper oxide compounds that transition above liquid nitrogen temperatures. You don't even need helium to cool these down. Right? And there's these newly discovered iron-based superconductors. You might think that iron has polarized spins and superconductors have oppositely polarized spins, they wouldn't work well together. But it turns out that there's this really interesting interplay between magnetism and superconductivity, and it allows superconductivity to exist at relatively high temperatures in these materials. Okay, so So superconductors are, are everywhere, and they're useful, right? These are a great, for me, it's a great field to work in because it's sort of fundamentally interesting as a collective effect. But there are also lots of applications of these. There are applications making, low volume wires. You can have high density power in these because you don't get any resistance, and so you can put, wires in high density, urban areas where you want very narrow wires to carry a lot of current. You can use them in low-weight wind turbines. The reduced wire heating, as I mentioned, makes them useful for MRI magnets or used in accelerators. They expel magnetic fields, which causes them to levitate when put next to a magnet. You can make levitating trains and flywheels that way. They're used for sensitive detectors. People here who are using in astronomy, for example, in telescopes, in looking at quantum phenomena, single photon detectors use superconductors. They do this by basically taking a material, putting it right at the transition point where the superconductor goes between superconducting and normal. Okay, so it's almost, it's just in the middle, so it has a very sharp slope, and then you put a single photon on there, and it transitions. Okay, so it's a very sensitive photon detector. The most sensitive. These are all that's used for single photon detection. Okay, and it's also used for electronic elements, magnetometers. This is someone getting their brain imaged by a superconducting loop that's sensitive to the magnetic to phase, and the magnetic field changes phase, so you can detect currents in brains. I think all of this is probably the liquefier on top of him. I hope it's not resting on his head. It looks kind of uncomfortable. But this is the squid magnetometer, brain imaging. Quantum computing elements are mostly based on, the solid state ones are largely based on superconducting junctions these days. So there's lots of applications and possible uses of superconductivity. So then you might say, okay, these are useful. It has no energy loss. Why isn't it everywhere, right? Why don't we just have some liquid nitrogen conduits and use superconductors everywhere we can? And the answer is that we're really still limited in the applications of superconductivity by our lack of understanding. And it's a shame because it's sort of, it's been 100 years since superconductivity was discovered. It's been 50 years since a basic theory was developed. But there's still not enough understanding, for example, of the high temperature superconductors, right? And you can just look at this plot here. This is a plot of TC versus the year it was discovered, right? And you can see that we went from sort of these elemental things of, 7 Kelvin, 10 Kelvin, all the way up to alloys, and then suddenly around 85, you jump up to 30 Kelvin, and you get this big jump to YBCO, right? These are high-temperature superconductors around 1985. It continues to go up to 1995, and it just saturates, right? So we haven't discovered a higher-temperature superconductor in almost 20 years, and I think that that's really limited by our lack of understanding of the mechanisms of high-temperature superconductivity. If we could really understand what's causing these to be high-temperature superconductors, we could start maybe designing things that would superconduct at higher and higher temperatures. We just don't have that fundamental understanding yet. And the reason for this is that things like high-temperature superconductors are actually very, very complicated. Right? So I gave you a description of how superconductivity works as an electron-phonon interaction. It turns out that's not really true for these high-temperature things. This is a phase diagram of temperature versus the doping of the copper oxide layer. And you can see that you get this very complicated phase diagram of anti-ferromagnetism, some sort of messy insulator, superconductivity only in some range, metals, strange metals, pseudo-gaps, right? The pseudo-gap is a region that has what looks like a superconducting gap, but it's not a full gap, and it's not superconducting, right? And then you lower the temperature, and you get into the superconducting region. So it's not known how this gap is related to this gap. People do things like STM of superconductors is above TC in this pseudo-gap region. You can see that you get this sort of phase-separated regions of gaps. You get one size gap here and no gap over there. So it looks like you get phase separation of gap, no gap, in this sort of pseudo-gap region. So there's lots of questions here. There's still many open questions. What is the nature of this pseudo-gap, for example? Is it related to the actual gap? What is the role of magnetism in superconductivity? What other types of collective behavior could be relevant? There's evidence of charge ordering, of spin ordering, stripes, evidence of phase separation. So there are really fundamental questions that still remain about the nature of superconductivity, especially in these sort of structures, these sort of materials. Okay. There are also fundamental questions about the nature of superconductivity in lower dimensions. Now, you might think, well, this is simple. You take a superconductor, it superconducts. You make it really small, and it superconducts. Why is that complicated? Well, it's complicated because if you make it really small, it stops superconducting. So superconductivity also depends on dimension, right? For example, if you have a 1D system, just thermal or quantum fluctuations destroy the phase along the wire, and the superconductivity is no longer phase coherent and doesn't exist. So you can't have a 1D superconductor, in the ground state. In 2D, you get phase correlation. You also have these fluctuations, but they decay as a power law. So it's sort of marginal to superconductivity in two dimensions, right? You also need to have grain sizes that are bigger than the pairing coherence length. You need to have limited disorder, limited phase fluctuations across the sample. So again, there's all these questions. What is the role of disorder in low-dimensional superconductors? What's the role of phase transitions, of phase separation? What other sorts of ground states can exist? Right? And I should mention that this is also relevant to these high-temperature superconductors, because high-temperature superconductors are actually layered quasi-2D systems. So the questions about superconductivity in 2D, for example, really inform our understanding of high-temperature superconductors. Okay. So this question here, what other types of ground states can exist? We already talked about things like strange metals, less strange metals, pseudo-gaps. You can have superconducting correlations, but all sorts of other phases there. Right? What do we expect to see in 2D systems? Right? Is it superconducting? Are they insulating? Are they metallic? What are our ground states? How do we achieve? What are their properties? And this is even more interesting in 2D because it turns out that theoretically, you're not even supposed to have a metal in 2D. Okay? Well, that's weird, right? We've all seen films that are metals, right? So that doesn't really jive with what we expect. But it turns out that if you have a real film, right, with just a little bit of disorder, every real system has a little bit of disorder, it could be a lattice dislocation or something, some charge on it, something like that, and you cool this thing down to absolute zero temperature, right, all of the electron wave functions will be pinned to the little bit of disorder, right? They'll be localized. And then they can't move and you get an insulator. So it's been theoretically predicted that as you approach zero temperature, any sort of finite disorder traps wave functions and no metallic state exists. So you can have a superconductor in 2D, you can have an insulator in 2D, but you shouldn't have a metal as it approaches zero temperature. Okay. This is the famous scaling theory of localization. Okay, but it turns out that evidence of sort of 2D metallic states have been observed in superconductors, in semiconductors. This is my thesis work. Look at these superconductor insulator transitions, and we see that sometimes we see a superconductor as a resistance versus temperature. It can superconduct. We get this very weak insulator, but for a wide range, we just see flat resistance. It looks like it's approaching a metallic state as we get to zero temperature, and this is just not understood well. Okay, why does it approach a metallic state at zero temperature? What causes this metallic state, and is it related to other anomalous metallic states, for example, in high-temperature superconductors? These are all open questions. And I just say that the open questions we're talking about for superconductivity, I'd argue that this is a model system. So the open questions in superconductivity are actually related to open questions in other collective systems. Now, in general, it's interesting to know what's the role of spin charge ordering, disorder, phase separation, dimensionality, what kind of phase transitions exist, what other types of ground states exist. These are general questions for collective electronic states. So if we can understand them in superconductors, perhaps we could apply that knowledge. If you phase separate a superconducting system, maybe that's similar to phase separating a magnetic system. Right? How do we control these parameters and understand it? Okay, so to tackle these questions, what we really want is a way of microscopically controlling superconductivity. Take one superconducting electron pair, right, and put them together, and somehow you get a little pair that we know of with a gap, and then you split them apart and you add something to it. Let's say you add some charge order, right, and then you get stronger pairing, high TC, right? That'd be great if we could do that at that level. Or we add something like a scatterer and we get a metallic state. We really want that level of microscopic control, even at the individual electron level, to determine what, to answer these questions and figure out what things like disorder and charge ordering do to our pairing. But, it turns out that in real life, it's hard to split a pair and put a scatterer right between it, at least in condensed matter. Maybe in atomic physics, they start doing these things, right? But in real materials, we just can't do that. Okay, so it seems like we're stuck. How do we get microscopic control of parameters, right, to understand the macroscopic behavior? What can we do? Okay. So one of the answers is that instead of taking just individual electrons, what if we took the superconductor but just started putting together small units of it, right? Take a superconducting island that has its own order, its own phase associated with it, Then take another superconducting island that has its own phase separate, associated with it, right? Now, if these islands are interacting, if we couple them together, then they have the same phase, right? And we can have pairs, superconducting pairs flow between them. So we have a net big superconductor. If they're not well coupled, the phases are different and no supercurrent flows. Okay. So in a sense, by coupling these islands together, we have a way of controlling superconductivity on a larger scale than the islands themselves. That makes sense. Right? And that's what we're really aiming for, sort of a small way of coupling things together to see large-scale phenomena. See, islands seem pretty good. This is actually a well-known effect. This is just what's called a Josephson junction. A Josephson junction is a superconductor, two superconductors connected by a weak link that can be sort of insulating or normal material. The superconductivity depends on the phase difference across the junction, right? And you can see things like an IV curve where you see a supercurrent in these sort of things. Okay, so what we want to do is control the superconductivity by controlling their coupling in these sort of Josephson junctions. So how do we control their coupling? Well, as I mentioned, we do it via these weak links that are connecting the superconductors. In our case, our weak links are the substrate. We put the superconductor on a substrate, right? And then they're connected by the substrate material. Okay? And for the case of a metallic substrate, the coupling between the islands depends both exponentially on the island spacing and on the coherence of the normal metal. By the coherence of the normal metal, I mean electrons have some phase coherence too. So if I have a pair in this superconductor and it wants to go to that superconductor, right? If the electrons lose coherence in the normal metal, the pair will never get there with the same phase, right? So I also care about the coherence length of the normal metal, and that just depends on the diffusion constant and the temperature. The normal metal coherence length gets larger at lower temperatures. Okay. There are other properties that also matter, things like if the islands are small, composed of grains, phase fluctuations. These things matter too, and we pay attention to those. But mostly we're trying to control the coupling between these islands in this way, using the spacing and the coherence length. Okay, so what do we do next? We want to control the coupling of a couple islands. But you don't want, like, you know, if you just put two islands together, then the properties of the islands dominate. You don't really want to think about just the microscopic small details, whether the edges are rough, whether they're exactly some distance apart. What we really want is to net change a bunch of microscopic parameters and then see how the macroscopic things change. So what we really want is an array of islands. Okay. So what we do is we make arrays of something like 10,000 to 30,000 islands on metallic substrates, and then change their configuration and properties and see how superconductivity changes. That's our way of taking these microscopic elements, the islands of the order of a couple hundred nanometers. They can be smaller or bigger, but we stick with this for now, right? And then couple them together and see how superconductivity changes in a macroscopic way. So in this case, we take niobium islands, put them on very thin gold layers, and then we get little arrows of phase that appear on top of them. Okay, the arrows don't really appear. We put those in, as you can see, but they kind of look like that. So this allows us to control interactions, look at the macroscopic phenomena. We make arrays of more than 10,000 of these islands. Okay, we have full control of the superconductor and the substrate materials. The other thing that's really nice about this is that we do everything independently using electron beam lithography. Right? So we can totally control every island size and position. So if someone said to me, you know, I want you to take all of these 30,000 islands and take out that island in that position and then measure it, we can do that. You know, I want you to shift these three in this way, we can do that. So we have total control over the coupling just by fabricating it. If you can make it in MATLAB, we can make it on a sample. Almost. But so far we've been able to. Everything we've tried to configure, we've just been able to make. And we can also show that as a whole, right, when these islands are coupled together, right, the whole thing, we measure the gold under the island, which has the superconducting pairs in it, and the whole thing acts like a two-dimensional superconductor. And I won't show you that data. We have a lot of data showing that, you know, the phase transition acts in a certain way. It's basically a Brzezinski-Kosterlitz-Thouless transition for people who know. When it's a 2D superconductor, we can fit exactly to that sort of transition. So it really looks like a 2D superconductor, but something we can change microscopically. And so this sort of system allows us now approach key questions related to superconductivity and collective phenomena. What's the effect of disorder as we move these things around? What's the effect of phase separation? This is an inherently phase-separated system. You know, can we see different ground states? Can we see 2D ground states? We saw it before in thin films. Can we create them in these sort of systems? What happens when we have different ranges of superconducting coupling? Okay. So I should mention that, you know, basically these are Josephson junction arrays. These have had a long history. These have actually been measured something like 30 years ago. Here's an example of a Josephson junction array from 1996 where they just, you know, patterned different things on different junctions on top of each other. In this case, they mostly looked at things like just the transition between superconductivity and an insulating state. They didn't worry too much about varying configurations, about metallic states. You know, the new things that we do here is our fabrication. Using electron beam lithography, we really have individual control of the island placement. Our islands are mesoscopic, unlike what was typically done before. They're a micron scale. That means that we can have coupling among multiple ranges of islands. Right. And also we're focusing on things like island spacing, 2D metallic states, substrates disorder, things that people just didn't look at before. And I also want to mention that island arrays are not an entirely new thing either. This is data from Ivan Schuler's group in San Diego from, again, you know, a long time ago, where he did magnetic islands on superconducting substrates. This is sort of an inverse experiment to what we're doing. Right? And I think that these are very complementary because, again, he wasn't really looking at transport in the superconductor. He was pinning vortices and trying to manipulate superconductivity this way. And so it's a complementary experiment, but again, looking at different things. You can also do things like make holes in superconducting films and look at superconductivity that way. Here, there's an issue because you get inhomogeneous material along the edges of these holes, which gives you a whole set of junctions a little bit less controlled. But it's a very interesting system. So there's a lot of interesting systems that I think are complementary to this one. And sometimes it matters what you're focusing on. And for the students out there, I want to make a little case about this, because when I first started working on these island arrays, I was really excited about it. There really hadn't been a lot of work done on it. But then, you know, a few of my more senior faculty came and said, "Oh, we did this 30 years ago. You're just repeating what we did." And, you know, it wasn't true. I didn't feel like it. But then I thought about it a little bit and I said, you know, that's fine. You know, even if the system has some similarities, you were really making it in new ways and thinking about entirely different physics. And there's always something to be learned in that case, right? So I was inspired by this quote from T.S. Eliot from Four Quartets, which says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Okay? And that's sort of a good lesson for life. And it's a good lesson for physics, too, because you can look at things from many different angles and use all the knowledge around you. But if there's still open questions, you know, you can find new ways of approaching those same questions and hopefully answering them, you know, the second time around. Okay, so here's the devices that we make. We take a gold film and we pattern it to a four-point structure. We put, you know, current on the outside leads, measure voltage on the inside, and then we cover part of it with superconducting islands, niobium islands there. Okay, and then we measure the resistance of the gold, right, which has become superconducting due to the presence of these islands. I just say the other thing, you know, making these took about, I don't know, 2.5 years of figuring out the fabrication, right? So it may look simple, but it actually took a long time to get the coupling perfect and to figure out the way to, you know, make 30,000 islands without having them all be connected or some partial ones being connected or something like that. But once we figured it out, it works every time now. It also took some time to get this down to the point where it took about an hour to make each of these arrays. And that's actually a really important thing. So if you ever do electron beam lithography, it costs something like $50 an hour. So if you want to make 6 samples on one chip and each sample takes you 5 hours, you just can't afford it and everyone will be mad at you because you've monopolized the e-beam. Right? So it's also important not just to know how to do it, but to know how to do these things quickly enough to get reproducible results on multiple samples, right? So that took some time as well. So to make these things, we start with a silicon oxide substrate. We spin on photoresist. Then we pattern our four-point patterns, evaporate gold, lift off. Then put PMMA on. Use the PMMA. Use our electron beam lithography to pattern the islands again. And you just use the MATLAB, a MATLAB pattern or something. Do whatever you want. Here we've used triangular arrays. And then we e-beam evaporate niobium. This is actually pretty important because if you sputter niobium, you'll never get rid of it in a way that keeps the island separated. And then we lift off to have niobium islands on our four-point pattern. Okay. So the first thing we looked at in this case was just the spacing dependence. Right. This is something that for one reason has just never been looked at before. What happens if you have these islands, right, sort of a phase-separated system, and then just systematically increase the spacing between them? So we took every chip, every silicon chip, we put 6 different four-point patterns on it, and they were all identical, all had the same amount of metal, same island diameter, same thicknesses of metals, And we just increased the spacing between the islands to see how superconductivity changed. There's an SEM of the islands themselves. I want to note that the islands are somewhat granular. You can see columnar grains in these of the order of about 30 nanometers in each island. Okay, just the device configuration here, we use the superconductor is of the order of 100 nanometers. Normal metal is about 10 nanometers, so the superconductor is much thicker than the normal metal. That means that all the metal under the superconductor basically superconducts. The island diameters I'm showing here are 260 nanometers. That's not varying. We can extract all sorts of parameters from these. The most important ones from the mean free paths, we can extract the coherence length of the superconductor, meaning that the superconductor should be coherent as long as you're above 27 nanometers. And we can actually extract this, the coherence length of the normal metal as well, and we get that's a temperature-dependent quantity of about 210 over root T. So importantly, the island diameter is always bigger than the coherence length. The island should always be superconducting. And the island spacing is also always bigger than this, than the normal metal coherence length, which means, you know, when you put the islands down, they shouldn't be coupled until you lower the temperature and increase that normal metal coherence length. And finally, as I mentioned, the niobium is granular with a grain size which is comparable to the coherence length. This is typical. This is common for evaporated niobium. Okay. So this is an optical image of our sample. Again, here's the gold pattern. Take the voltage across here. Put the current across there. This big square you see is the islands. We cover the leads a little bit just to make sure it's all homogeneous when we measure it. Okay. We measure these at low temperatures, superconductor, right? Pumped helium cryostat or a helium-3 refrigerator, pumped helium-3, or a pumped mixture of helium-3, helium-4. And here's the sort of data that we get. Now, we adjust, I should say, that we make our samples such that we can measure all of the samples in one measurement system. You don't want to take the thing out and measure one thing at low temperature, another thing at high temperature. We make sure that for the six devices on each chip, they all have transitions within the range of one of these systems. Right, so that limits a little bit the range of spacings that we measure. So here's an example of the data. What you see here is resistance versus temperature for different island spacings. Right? So the closest together islands have a single transition here around 9 Kelvin. That's good because that's around the transition temperature of niobium. That tells us we have really good coupling for our islands. And then as we increase the spacing, we can see the transition temperatures go to lower and lower temperatures, as you might expect, right? We're separating the superconducting parts more and more. We're suppressing superconductivity. Okay? And you also note that there's a two-step transition here, right? You see these are normalized, right? But basically, if you start from the normal state, you get one transition and then a second transition. Now, this two-step transition is actually expected, right? The first transition should occur when the niobium islands themselves become superconducting, right? So the islands are just sitting there by themselves. They superconduct at 9 Kelvin at some temperature, right? And then the islands are still pretty well separated, right? So they're not phase coherent yet. The film isn't superconducting. So then you have to lower the temperature. And as you lower the temperature, the normal metal coherence length increases until it becomes comparable to the spacing between the islands. At that point, the islands can become coherent, right? They get the same phase, and the whole film becomes superconducting. That's the second transition. So here, the first step is the island transition, and the second step is where the whole film becomes superconducting across the array. So that's fine, but then you say, well, if the first step is the island transition, why does it depend on spacing? And so, I'll admit to you that I showed this data at a conference, and it was just hot off the press. We had just gotten, and I was happy we just saw anything, right? And I showed this plot. I said, this works. And someone raised their hand and said, well, why does T1 depend on spacing? I sort of looked at it. I'm like, I don't know. That's weird, right? It's weird because down here, T2 is where you have phase coherence between the islands. That's where they're coupled. Right? Above that temperature, they shouldn't be coupled. Above that temperature, they're just individual islands. But the fact that T1 depends on spacing tells us that there's actually some coupling happening up here and a different range of coupling that happens down here. Okay? That's something that's quite unusual. Okay? And actually, this happens consistently. You can see that we tried it for thicker niobium and for thinner niobium. And for the thicker niobium, you can see that the transition goes to higher temperatures, but it still depends on spacing. Right? And again, this is weird. The island diameter is 10 times the coherence length. The island should always be superconducting. But somehow, The transition is suppressed with increased island spacing. And in fact, if you plot this, you see that the transition of the islands is linearly suppressed with spacing, right? As you increase the spacing, the transition of the islands themselves drops linearly with spacing, okay? So what's cool about that? What's cool about that is that it means that if we just keep increasing the spacing, right, we have this sort of metallic, it's not superconducting here, right? The islands are marginally superconducting. The transition point is just where they're about to become superconducting. But that decreases linearly with spacing. So as we increase the spacing between islands, we're basically marching this point down, and it's linear, so it seems like we should be able to march it down to zero temperature, where we end up with a zero temperature metallic state. Make sense? So you just extrapolate this line, and it extrapolates to zero for finite spacing. That implies you're going towards what looks like this anomalous zero temperature metallic state, okay? Which is cool, right? So this could be one mechanism for getting these zero temperature metallic states, and it could be something that people see when they see these sort of anomalous 2D metallic states. It could be due to these sort of phase-separated islands, right? We measure this in lots of different samples of different spacings. Here we've measured it on less resistive gold substrates, more resistive gold substrates. You can see that TC drops faster for more resistive gold, but it's still linear. Larger island spacings, it still drops linearly. Unfortunately, as you get to really large island spacings, you can see that the transition sort of smears out. So as you go down here, it's so smeared out, it's hard to measure what it is, but it's still always, as far as, you know, whenever we can measure it, it drops linearly. Okay. So what's causing this, right? Now I should mention that it is well known that the existence of a normal metal can suppress transitions, right? If I have a very thin superconductor and put a mile of normal metal on it, I can suppress superconductivity. But we're not in that regime in this case, right? In fact, you can see that, you know, for the closely spaced islands, I mean, for a bilayer of these films is very similar to closely spaced islands. These have transition temperatures around 9 Kelvin, right? We're not suppressing superconductivity, you know, just by the presence of the normal metal. Otherwise, we wouldn't transition at the temperature of niobium, right? And we can also, we have lots of other reasons for showing this, including the fact that you know, because we're all with the spacing is always larger than the normal metal coherence length, even if we were saturating, you'd still always expect the same transition temperature. You can't really explain the linear dependence of the transition temperature on any sort of influence of the normal metal. Okay. So then what could be causing this approach to a metallic state, this linear dependence? Well, it turns out that what we think is that we're actually getting phase fluctuations on the individual grains. Right, so the island is composed of grains. These grains have some phase associated with them. And the islands themselves don't want to superconduct. Now, that's weird, because they're bigger than the coherence length, but somehow they don't want to superconduct. We've actually measured this. We've taken one island on a little patch of gold and measured it, and it doesn't superconduct. We've taken two islands, doesn't superconduct. We've taken five islands, and it has a suppressed TC. Then we take 20 islands, and TC goes back up again. So we can show by individual measurements that the individual islands don't superconduct, okay? So if that's due to something like phase fluctuations, that means that those sort of phase fluctuations are stabilized by a weak coupling to the neighbors. So a weak coupling between islands stabilizes the grain, the fluctuation on individual islands, allows individual islands to superconduct, and then at lower temperatures, you get a coherent state amongst the islands themselves, okay? So weak coupling to nearest to neighboring islands damps the phase fluctuations, enables superconductivity on the individual islands, right? But regardless of the mechanism, I think the really important thing to note here is that in these sort of phase-separated systems, as you increase the island spacing, you can see that there's a stabilized regime of what we call regional correlations, right? It's something that's not globally coherent, right? Nor is it non-coupled. It's sort of weakly coupled among nearest neighbors. So you think of things like pseudo-gap phases, right? They're not full gaps, but they're still little bits of gaps. Maybe they're local gaps, similar to what we have here. Okay. And the other thing is that the finite resistance region we see could persist as T goes to zero. So all this evidence of T equals zero metallic states, right? When it looks like we're approaching a zero-temperature metallic state, we could be approaching this sort of state as well. All right, so this could be related to these pseudo-gaps or unusual metallic properties in other systems. Okay, so you know what we're working on now is things like, you know, so it turns out that, you know, this idea of putting superconducting grains on a normal metal has been studied theoretically. In fact, there's a lot of theories that show that putting superconducting grains on normal metals can lead to a metallic state, this quantum superconductor metal transition, right? A theory of quantum fluctuations in an array of islands, right, leads to a metal transition at zero temperature. Again, a quantum superconductor metal transition, theory of quantum metal superconductor transition, highly conducting systems. There's lots of theories that show that indeed you can create these anomalous metallic states these ways. And so we're now trying to compare our results directly to the theories. We're looking at tunneling measurements to directly look at gaps in the state, directly compare it to pseudogaps using scanning tunneling microscopy, magnetic susceptibility. I'm not going to mention this at all today, but we've been studying the second transition, T2. We also see evidence of a metallic state there, an unusual behavior. We see the saturation of resistance. I'm not even going to mention that. And finally, we're also studying the magnetic field dependence. I want to say just a little bit about magnetic field because it's a pretty picture. We're almost done. So in the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to quickly just say a little bit about magnetic fields and a little bit about different island configurations, and we'll be done. Okay, so not only can we see things like how the transition temperatures vary with island spacings, right? You know, those are interactions among islands, but you can also look at interactions among vortices. Right? So basically, magnetic fields oppose pairing, but fields can penetrate as vortices, which are basically circulating currents containing single flux quantum. Okay, these are the excitations of a superconductor, and if you have a lattice like an island array, the vortices will pin the excitations. Like if you put in a small field, or if you just have thermal fluctuations, they can pin at the weakest, the most weakly superconducting points. And in our case, the most weakly superconducting points are the spaces between the superconducting islands. Okay, so you'd expect that vortices can enter with small fields, and they pin at spaces between these islands. Okay, and actually, what happens is they can pin, they organize themselves into an array and pin, you know, depending on the nature of the vortex array that can be created, right? So you get pinning sites at the center of each plaquette. If you have a rational number of vortices per plaquette, a rational fraction, let's say you have, you know, 20 pinning sites and you fill it with 10 vortices, they arrange themselves into a lattice structure due to interactions, and they pin there, and instead of moving resistively, they just stay, okay? And if you add one more vortex, it can't pin anywhere, so that moves resistively. So you get transitions from superconducting to non-superconducting just by putting on a magnetic field and getting commensurate filling of vortices. If that makes sense. And that's actually what you see here. This is resistance versus basically a magnetic field. Here I put it in terms of frustration, which is just the number of vortices per plaquette. So here we have one vortex per four plaquettes. You can see we go from superconducting, increase the magnetic field, it becomes resistive. Then we get one vortex per four plaquettes. It drops back to zero resistance. You know, it goes up, drops to zero at half filled, you know, two vortices per four plaquettes, three vortices, and then full filling, one vortex per plaquette. You go back to a zero resistance state. And so this is collective behavior of the vortices now, instead of just collective behavior of the pairs. Okay. And so we've been looking at things like phase transitions between these states, we've been looking at scaling, you can look at vortex dynamics, collective depinning from glassy states to flowing vortices to killing superconductivity altogether. And this is very active work in our group right now. Looking at this, some of this frustration, again, has been seen before, but really not so clearly and definitely not through all these different dynamical regimes. Okay. The last thing I want to mention is that, you know, because we have so much control over these systems, we're now looking at different sorts of lattice configurations, things that you maybe can't see as easily in just, you know, solid-state materials, as well as putting these on different sorts of substrates. So here's an example of, these are e-beam patterns, but we actually made these samples, right? Here's controlling disorder in a controlled way, right? Here's an ordered sample of islands. The islands are these little blue things which you can barely see, right? And what we do is we take the island and assign, we have some Gaussian function with some average width, and then we assign each island a random value within that Gaussian width. Okay? And then we change the Gaussian width and assign each island another random value within that width. And that allows us to parameterize disorder, right? The larger the width, the more disorder we add in a totally controlled way. And so here's an example of, you know, the width changing from zero ordered to 0.1, somewhat disordered, to 0.35, totally disordered, right? We can add correlated disorder, not just point disorder, but just things that are ordered on a local scale. You can see here, see how these guys have like sort of a square array ordered here? but disordered on a large scale. We can change that disorder range from power law to exponential to different sorts of cutoffs. Okay? And this really mimics the sort of things you might expect in maybe charge-ordered materials, more complex structures, right? We're looking at things, can we increase TC? Can we increase HC? Can we sharpen up the transition? You know, can we create other sorts of states that exist, new sort of vortex interactions? We're looking at unusual configurations. Here's one that's a spiral arrangement of vortices. It's called phyllotaxis. It's the way that sunflower seeds arrange themselves on a pod. It's the closest packing in 2D, and we can just measure these. We have measured this one. Unfortunately, it looked kind of like a square array, because if you look locally, it's square, so we need to make it a more broad spiral. But, you know, if we can think of it, if you think it might have interesting phenomena, there's a recent paper that came out that if you make the islands very dense on one side, and then make the density decrease as you go up laterally, then put a current across that way, you can drastically enhance TC by pinning vortices. So we're just making that now to measure it. Right. We're also doing this on all sorts of new materials. We've put islands on graphene, see really weird magnetoresistance effects. We put islands on topological insulators. We see weird sorts of magnetic frustration that maybe is different because of the surface states. You know, we have a lot of control, and we basically put them on everything these days because they're cool, and I like them, so why not? So, you know, so you can. So, but it turns out that when you do this, it's a way you can think of this as a way of making any other material into a macroscopic superconductor that you can control. Right, so topological insulators, these new materials, they have these weird spin polarized surface states, blah, 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 right? And now, and it's, you know, if you connect them to superconductors, you get a Majorana state, and now we can just make it into a superconductor macroscopically and measure things like Hall effect, right? You can really have a lot of control over these sort of systems. Okay, so in conclusion, I hope I've shown that these superconducting islands are really tunable superconducting systems. Right? We have a lot of control over these. We can observe interesting behavior like 2D metallic states, magnetic frustration, and you know, we hope to show that they're really model systems for studying not just superconductivity, but the issues are irrelevant to collective behavior. And I should say that you know, most of the work that I showed today was done by just several students, Serena Ely, pictured here. She's now working at Sandia, Malcolm Durkin, and a lot of theoretical support from Saran Gopalkrishnan and Paul Goldbart, as well as support from the DOE. So leave it at that and ask for questions. Thank you.